KALW.
The food that I cook is the food that I grew up eating. I may put a little twist on things.
Today, a San Francisco chef explores what home cooking really means.
Make sure it's hot sauce on the table. If I don't have hot sauce, I need to close.
A taste of Texas in the Bay. Then we meet an artist who positions our consumer society against the fossils that fuel it.
I just thought dinosaurs are the perfect hook because they're so well-loved. It's just a way to kind of put a more playful spin on it.
And San Francisco supervisor Aaron Peskin centers housing in his campaign for mayor.
I have a record of bringing people together. The YIMBY-NIMBY dynamic is a terrible dynamic.
Today, it's all about the city by the bay. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Like a lot of people in San Francisco, Fernay McPherson's family came here from somewhere else. Her mother and grandmother moved to the Fillmore District in the 1960s. They were part of the Great Migration that brought African Americans from the South to cities across the United States. When those families migrated, their recipes did too. KALW's Sarah Jesse takes us into Fernay's kitchen, where she revisits the recipes of her Texas family.
I'm in the kitchen of Chef Fernay McPherson's new restaurant, Minnie Bell's Soul Movement. She and her team are prepping some signature dishes: rosemary fried chicken, cornbread, and pound cake. Minnie Bell serves pound cake from Fernay's family recipe. Her great-grandmother was very protective of that cake.
When she had a pound cake in the oven, we couldn't move because she thought the cake was gonna fall and, you know.
And it literally accompanied her on her move to California in the 1960s.
When she migrated on the train, my grandmother made fried chicken and pound cake for their ride.
So even though Fernay has never lived in the South herself, that pound cake tastes like Texas.
Gotta get those brown butter bits.
Yes, definitely. That's where all the flavor is.
In April 2024, Fernay opened Minnie Bell's in the Fillmore. When you walk in, you're immediately greeted with a mural-sized photo of the neighborhood and its heyday. There are two huge black-and-white portraits of Fernay's grandmother and great-aunt gracing the walls. These are the women she learned to cook from. And when I chatted with the friends, family, and passersby who came to the opening, it became very clear very quickly. Her food has fans.
What's your favorite thing on the menu?
Oh, the fried chicken.
This is delicious. I'm having a two-piece right now.
When you get a recipe from your grandmother, it's nothing better than that.
Plate looks amazing. Thank you, Chef.
These fans have followed her from her food truck days to the Emeryville Public Market and now to the Fillmore. When that food truck launched in 2013, San Francisco was in the middle of a Southern food craze. But back then, the Bay Area food scene wasn't so quick to recognize chefs like Fernay, home cooks who had sharpened their skills to restaurant-level quality.
It was a white male-dominated field. All the write-ups were going to these fancy white restaurants.
Places that featured foams, smokes, and thin swipes of sauce. Highly engineered foods with big flavors packed into small bites.
People were trying to elevate soul food and make it fine dining. And I was trying to find my niche in that area where it's like, oh, I have to do something different with macaroni and cheese and elevate it to this level and make it little on a big plate with some type of sauce and pretty. And I definitely was trying that. And then I was like, why? Why am I doing that?
Fernay was drawn to the restaurant meals happening behind the scenes, staff meals.
Now, this is not the meals that the customers would see. This is meals that the prep cooks, the line cooks would make that would be so amazing, but you didn't see it in restaurants.
Those meals made her realize she wasn't interested in okra smoke. She joined the culinary incubator, La Cocina.
And I was in the kitchen with a bunch of different women that were doing what they do.
All those women, those home cooks working to start food businesses, were creating absolutely delicious meals rooted in their cultures, their lineages, and their own family histories. And that helped Fernay sharpen her own culinary voice.
The food that I cook is the food that I grew up eating. I may put a little twist on things, you know, I went to culinary school and learned some technique, learned different things, but it still resonates with the food that I grew up eating, and that's important.
She definitely still makes her family's fried chicken, but she's added a very California twist, fresh rosemary. When she nailed that recipe, she realized she didn't need to elevate anything.
And it doesn't have to be so bougie, just good food.
Fernay turned to her favorite food memories for inspiration.
My dad, he loved to barbecue. And it's a picture of my younger brother and I, and we were sitting on the porch, and we had, like, two huge ribs that was bigger than us. I can go somewhere and eat barbecue, but it doesn't taste like my dad's.
When she makes her family's recipes, it's like she's telling those family stories through food.
If I open up a restaurant that's not part of my culture, I won't be able to tell that story.
Fernay learned how to cook from her great aunt and grandmother, Minnie and Lilybelle, respectively. They're the namesakes of Minnie Bell's. It's their portraits on her restaurant's walls, and it's their standards she's trying to meet when she cooks.
I know what it tasted like when my grandmother made it. I know what it tasted like when my aunt or my mom made it. And I know, okay, I need to recreate that flavor.
Speaking of family, mine is from the South too, Southwest Virginia, not Texas. As a Southern woman, I also grew up mixing cornbread batter and licking spoons. But as a white woman, I would never open up a soul food restaurant. Personally, I couldn't, because soul food comes from African Americans in the South. Here's the mother of soul food, Edna Lewis, speaking in a documentary on Southern cooking.
In the beginning, blacks were really the only cooks, and they're the ones that developed the food of the South, which they call Southern hospitality. And through their cooking, they developed techniques and flavor.
She talks about how African Americans were really the ones who developed the food we think of as Southern food.
And they truly produce the only regional cuisine in this country is a Southern cuisine, fully developed.
Part of the story of soul food is the story of creating abundance from scarcity, when enslaved people were only given the off cuts of meat and other undesirable ingredients that would otherwise go wasted. With those leave-behinds, soul food cooks created and have continued creating comfort and joy. Fernay recalls a time when she was at the receiving end of that comfort.
When I was pregnant with my son and I was just eating like a little pig, and I was like, oh, I want to stop eating.
But her son's grandmother insisted.
You eat until your heart is full. And I was like, oh, thank you. Let me make another plate.
Those feelings are infused into Frenay's food. And others, regardless of their cultural background, feel it too. Back at the Minnie Bell's kitchen, prep cook Facundo Mundo Perez is cleaning rosemary for the fried chicken. He says that his sister cooks food from Mexico, where they're from, and he's transported back home.
Te transportas al lugar donde eres.
And he thinks the same is true of Fernay's food.
Y pienso que igual aquí, cuando la gente prueba la comida de la chef Fernay, se transportan a su lugar o recuerdan su estado.
Fernay's food is from her family's roots in Texas, but her restaurant is all about her own roots here in the Bay. Because it's in the Fillmore, the neighborhood she grew up in, it's like she's coming home. And Fernay says she wants to be a part of a long-promised renaissance here.
Welcome home, Chef Fernay.
Welcome home, Chef Fernay.
Years ago, she was looking for validation from critics. But now, she's just excited to cook for the community she grew up with.
When elders come in and they tell me, oh, this food is so good, that's it for me. That's it for me. My Aunt Minnie, she said to me one day, she said, you are getting better and better. That's it for me. that's all the validation that I need.
In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Jussie for Cross Currents.
It's all in the food. Make sure it's hot sauce on the table. You know, it will be hot sauce on every table. So if I don't have hot sauce, I need to close.
Sarah reported that story as part of this year's Audio Academy, and she's graduating today. Congratulations, Sarah. You can find all of Sarah's stories at klw.org/crosscurrents. And if you want to try Chef Fernet's cooking, Minnie Bell's is open Tuesdays through Saturdays.
Let's all celebrate and have a good time.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. We live in a consumer culture.
I'm Travis Scott. This is my McDonald's order.
Want a Dorito?
Doritos?
Jake from State Farm. You couldn't find a standard that looked anything like me?
Good thing I had Aflac.
Snag a dad win with Domino's new sauce bottom pizza.
It's capitalism, and our consumption has had great consequences, like climate change. San Francisco artist Michael Kerbo uses his talents to illustrate that connection. The painter is currently showing a collection depicting dinosaurs interacting with how we now use their remains as fuel. The exhibit is at the 111 Minna Gallery. KALW recently hosted an event there, and executive producer Ben Trefney sat down with Kerbo before a live audience to discuss his work.
Well, let's go ahead and describe behind us here on the stage at 111 Minna. There is this piece. What do you call this one?
That's called Late Capitalism. That's sort of like the foundational work in the whole series.
Okay. And so what I see is a variety of kinds of dinosaurs that are in what looks almost like what could be sort of a mini mall or like maybe like the rest stop off of a highway with all the kinds of like big corporate fast food, gas stations, Denny's, Sonic, Taco Bell, and there's wrecks of cars and there's mud pits and there's dinosaurs that are thriving in this environment actually.
It's meant to be kind of like a tongue-in-cheek kind of representation of Americana. And I intentionally put in as much signage as possible. So if a viewer were to like look up, I mean, the painting is basically 13 feet wide. It's quite large. And if you look closely, there's just like, it goes on forever with this series of infinite signage off in the distance. The overall composition, by the way, I should give a shout out to the a lot of this work in this particular show is sort of inspired by vintage paleo art. So by that I mean like illustration from the, I don't know, the mid 20th century showing dinosaurs at the time. And I didn't really choose to kind of make these creatures, I guess, scientifically accurate to today's science, but rather more of a throwback to the nostalgia of my childhood.
Yeah, they look like the ones from my memory of my youth.
Exactly. I mean, that's partly what my own sort of personal agenda behind this series was, kind of indulging in my childhood, like imagination, my fantasy life of dinosaurs and cars were kind of like my two main obsessions as a kid. And
just like a whole lot of us, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Paleontology and automobiles.
And I guess the choice of using this imagery was intentional also because, as you can imagine, when you're kind of exploring somewhat heavy or sobering subject matter like, you know, climate change, for example, how do you make it engaging to an audience in such a way that they're willing to, you know, take the time to actually look at it? And I just thought dinosaurs are the perfect hook because they're so, you know, everybody loves them and they're so well-loved that it's just a way to kind of put a more playful spin on it. And then underneath all that, you kind of recognize the sort of darker kind of subtones to the work.
And so I want to go back to when you probably had art in you for a long, long time, but you used to work in a more commercial industry before you turned to this. Tell me a little bit about that and then how you made that transition into, you know, spending a lot more of your time creating artwork like this.
Sure. I remember initially it was primarily a lot of liquor and cigarette advertising. I used to do a lot of that.
No kidding.
Like Joe Camel, if you happen to remember him, I used to do all that illustration work.
Really?
Well, I should clarify. I didn't actually do the illustrations outright. Those were done by airbrush artists, but rather the paintings that these illustrators would make would be photographed, and then I would do all this manipulation and like changing and all these edits based on the...
Yeah, I mean, Joe Camel was incredibly popular, like kind of on a par with the Marlboro Man.
Yeah.
Until they're like, this is kind of appealing to children.
Well, I used to tell people, you know, I meet the party or whatever, and they'll like ask what I did for a living, and I say, oh, I promote death.
Yeah. No.
It's not like I have any guilt about, you know, working in the advertising industry. I see it as having, you know, a purpose. But I guess my current focus as an artist is more to kind of, I guess, explore the idea that our level of consumption is totally unsustainable. I mean, we live on a finite-sized planet, and yet the whole idea of capitalism is built on this principle that it's continually got to be growing and growing and growing and getting bigger, you know, buying more, selling more, consuming more ad infinitum. And yet some point it's, you know, going to reach a wall and something's going to give. So that's where I'm trying to like talk about the fact that this has got an end game that is really not ultimately what we want. I'm trying to say, hey, folks, this is going to change. Something's got to, we need a better plan here.
That was San Francisco artist Michael Kerbo speaking with KALW executive producer Ben Trefney. Kerbo's art will be on display at the 111 Mina Gallery until June 20th. We've got a link to his work at KALW.org/crosscurrents.
Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. San Francisco's mayoral race is already underway. Our friends at KALW's State of the Bay are interviewing the candidates. Today, Aaron Peskin. Peskin is president of the Board of Supervisors and represents District 3. He was first elected in 2000 and is now serving his fifth non-consecutive term. Here's his conversation with State of the Bay host Gray Swan.
Why are you choosing to run for mayor now?
Well, I think San Francisco has a number of challenges, and I think the quarter of a century on and off that I've had in public life, learning every aspect of public policy, working consensually with my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors, having experienced a number of different mayoral administrations, really have given me the tools that I need to run the city. Look, I think the number one issue for all of us is housing, particularly affordable housing, and I'm in it to fix it. And I think there are a number of exciting opportunities. And even in an economic downturn, there are opportunities. Tomorrow, I will be announcing legislation to get the city and county of San Francisco, with its financing might, its ability to access tax-exempt financing, to use its Office of Public Finance to provide financing for a host of projects that have been stuck in the pipeline for downtown office-to-housing conversions.
Well, you mentioned mentioned financing to maybe for the city to acquire housing. I mean, the city's facing a budget deficit and its bond rating is in question on some level. So are we really in a position to do all those things?
Well, it's interesting that you raise that. I have been a champion of affordable housing bonds and indeed was the principal force behind the March bond that we passed last month, that provides $300 million for new affordable housing construction in San Francisco. The kind of bonds that I am proposing tomorrow are actually have no recourse to the city's general fund, do not impact our bond rating. These are tax-exempt bonds that the city can issue. It's a cheaper source of financing. It would be paid for through the revenue from rents. And this is really to address moderate income housing, workforce housing for our bus drivers, for our first responders, for our educators.
Well, it's interesting. You're going to introduce a bond tomorrow. Today, Mayor Breed announced a $167 million bond herself. I mean, is this bond time for candidates who are running for mayor?
No, I'm not introducing a bond. I'm introducing a form of financing where the city would be the conduit financer for for-profit and nonprofit developers. I'm not putting a bond on the ballot. I'm creating a new tool to unstick the housing pipeline where some 71,000 units have been fully entitled, are ready to build. But because of the interest costs, because rents are down in San Francisco, nobody is availing themselves of the current commercial lending market. It is too expensive. This is an alternative source of financing.
And you've just been describing all the moderate housing that you want to build. And I guess my question to you is, where in the city is this housing going to be built? Because you just authored legislation to block high rises in and around Jackson Square. And that was going to be housing for people, but I guess not in your district.
So, Grace, my record actually speaks to over 100,000 units that I have helped authorize from the Bayview Hunters Point Shipyard to the Eastern Neighborhoods rezoning that I led in 2007-2008, Rincon Hill, Central Soma, Western Soma, and opportunities in the northeast corner of the city, the first settled, the densest part of the second densest city in America, where we rebuilt all of the former freeway parcels into dense, affordable housing for families, for individuals. But the reality is that if we are going to develop San Francisco, we have to include the people of San Francisco in those conversations.
Well, another issue that is kind of plaguing the city is this feeling of public safety. I mean, what's the appropriate measure that a resident of the city should use in terms of whether this is a safe place or not?
Well, first of all, I think you just hit it, Grace, which is people need to feel safe. And part of that is a narrative that some of us perpetuate. Part of that is quality of life crimes that I've personally experienced. I had my catalytic converter stolen. I had a window broken. But I think that having community policing, augmenting that with ambassadors, who many of whom are former police officers. The story that I've experienced in the northeast corner of the city that I've represented for most of the last 25 years, where we have real community policing, a lot of folks who grew up in the city, who grew up in Chinatown, who know the shop owners, who know the residents. That's what all of San Francisco deserves. I proposed earlier this month, creating a schools to officers pathway where people can go to local universities and become peace officer trained as part of their curriculum that will bring city kids, if you will, into law enforcement and guarantee them a job and not require a long, rigorous training. Instead, they would get that actually in college, because right now, and San Francisco is not unique in this way, we are down hundreds of officers. This is not an issue of money, Grace. These are fully funded vacant positions that we need to fill, and we can't go about it in a piecemeal fashion. We have to really intentionally figure out a pathway to bring officers who are part of 21st century policing.
Well, we have an email from a San Franciscan who writes, how do you balance the personal rights of the unhoused with the right for other citizens to feel safe? What are your guiding principles in that debate?
My guiding principles to that debate are precisely what I have done with community collaboration in the northeast corner of the city, which is shelter. We can squeeze this toothpaste tube and we can move it from one neighborhood to another. But ultimately, if you have a citywide perspective, maybe one supervisor wins temporarily, another supervisor and their constituents lose. It's fundamentally about shelter. We were able to create the first transitional age youth center shelter in a navigation center in the northeast corner of the city, where the neighbors were at the table and became supportive. We were able to open one of the largest shelters in San Francisco on Post Street, 250 units done in close collaboration with the neighbors. I am not saying it has not had its hiccups. It has had, but we continue to meet on a regular basis between the provider, the Department of Homelessness, my office, myself included, and the neighborhood. And if we do that and we create that example, we can do that in other neighborhoods. And the answer is we've got to shelter these people.
Do you have a ranked choice voting strategy?
I think everybody should use their votes. We are given the ability to vote for 10 different individuals. I think that we should all use our votes and we should rank those individuals. And that is the best way to be enfranchised.
So no strategy.
My strategy is to win. My strategy is to go all over this city, every corner. I love the neighborhoods of this city.
That was San Francisco mayoral candidate Aaron Peskin. He spoke with State of the Bay host Grace Wan. You can hear the full interview and hear all our election coverage at kelw.org/elections. And while you're there, tell us what local issues are on your mind for the upcoming election. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.